All right. It's now my great pleasure to introduce our next keynote speaker, Professor Claire Colebrook. Claire Colebrook is the Edwin Errol Sparks Professor of English at Penn State University. She's published numerous works on Gilles Deleuze, visual art, poetry, queer theory, film studies, literature, culture studies, and visual culture. She's the editor with Tom Cohen of Critical Climate Change book series, published with Open Humanities Press. And some notable works of hers include Deleuze, A Guide for the Perplexed, which, on a personal note, absolutely saved me when I first started reading Deleuze and Guattari. So I'm eternally grateful for that. Irony and the Work of Philosophy, Gender, Irony, Milton, Evil, and Literary History, Deleuze and the Meaning of Life, and she's most recently authored Death of the Posthuman and Sex After Life, a two-volume series entitled Essays on Extinction, published online and for free with the Open Humanities Press. The title of her talk today is Scale and Refuge, Twilight of the Anthropocene. So I give you Professor Claire Colebrook.
Thanks for the kind introduction. Thanks for inviting me here, and thanks for bringing me, a couple of hours early on, because there's a chance I might be somewhat awake still in half an hour. I can't guarantee that you will be, but I'll do my best. Before I get going with the body of the talk, I'm going to make two notes on what I'm doing methodologically, because uncharacteristically for me it's a semi-act based talk. I don't deal with facts generally, but I'm drawing on a few. So the first thing I'm doing methodologically is what I consider to be basic deconstruction. That is, there is an assumed order between being born in a place, having a nation, and having a citizenship, natality, who one is in the place and where one's born, and then the accidental, unfortunate condition of being displaced or being a refugee. Such that the refugee is the exceptional condition that things like human rights organisations are there to address. And what I'm doing is reversing, seeing that accident, the condition of being a refugee, as being the condition. In the beginning, we're all refugees. And when I use we, because I'm a Deleuzian, I mean even non-humans. In the beginning, life is migration or displacement or homelessness. That's the origins of life, is moving from a hostile environment from the origins of life onwards. So what seems to be the exception is actually the transcendental condition. So in the beginning, we're all refugees. It follows from that, and it's sort of continuing in a deconstructive vein, that there's now some debate within legal discourse primarily about whether there's a legitimate category of climate refugees. So I did some very uncharacteristic for me, I did some actual research rather than just making stuff up. And so I looked into climate refugees, and the issue seems to be, which strikes me as a good issue, whether this notion of climate refugees isn't merely a way of covering over what are actually political displacements, that is, famines and conditions of hardship that are caused by humans' relation to other humans rather than anything to do with the ecosystem. So the question of climate refugees is a question, is this another category? So again, being deconstructed, I want to say that all refugees are climate refugees. So in the beginning is the refugee, in the beginning is a condition of migration, and that migration occurs because of the history of humans and the history of life being one of constant depletion, appropriation, misappropriation. So all refugees are climate refugees. I therefore want to deconstruct the opposition between supposedly legitimate refugees who are fleeing conditions of genuine hardship and impossibility and supposed illegitimate refugees who are really economic migrants. I want to deconstruct that opposition and say every refugee is a climate refugee, every migrant is a climate refugee fleeing from one inhospitable home to another, less inhospitable, not an inhospitable home. And then ultimately, I want to deconstruct, which doesn't just mean pull apart, but reverse the notion of the citizen of the nation with the refugee and say that there are only nations, citizens, because of a certain refusal or inhospitability to a general condition of refuge, which is the condition of life. Life is a seeking of refuge, or the organic life is a sequence of refuge. Okay, here comes the paper proper, which begins, as I say, uncharacteristically with a fact. In 1972, and I'm referring by and large throughout this paper to the Australian context, so I apologise if there are any other Australians in the room for whom this will be all too familiar. In 1972, in response to a refusal by the Australian government, not the Australian federal government, but the Northern Territory, so there are states and territories, Northern Territory government made a legal decision to refuse Indigenous Australians land rights and instead awarded mining rights to a corporation. In response to that legal decision in 1972, a group of Australian Aborigines erected a tent embassy outside the Australian Houses of Parliament. If I were a good person and had images, but I knew there were going to be problems, so I decided not to assume that we all have iPhones, so you can just Google Australian tent embassy images and you'll get a much better resolution than if I had found the appropriate adapter. So by constructing an embassy outside the Australian Houses of Parliament, several events occurred. First, the Aboriginal people became a people. So this series of dispersed tribes declared themselves to be aliens in their own land. And in doing so, in that act of refusal, they also took part in discourses of sovereignty and nationhood by building an embassy, even though it was a tent, outside the Houses of Parliament. The tent embassy itself has a long and contentious history of being removed, set up, and so forth. The Indigenous Australians who erected the tent embassy, in the very gesture of declaring themselves aliens in their own land, that rebellious gesture, they nevertheless became discursive hostages, precisely because they had to deploy the concepts of nation, sovereignty, ownership, land rights, and legitimate usage, this land is ours, that were hallmarks of the very legal system that had refused them land in the first place. There was then and has been an ongoing debate within Indigenous Australian politics about what is the better strategy for Indigenous Australians to declare this land is ours, to appeal to property laws, in which case they buy into notions of property and ownership, which have to be negotiated by the Australian legal system, or should they be upping the ante and refusing that system and declaring themselves to be sovereign? But of course, in doing that, they buy into a different discursive system of sovereignty, both of which are alien to whatever original philosophy of the earth and themselves that was Indigenous. For those of you who aren't aware of the history of that legal decision to refuse Australian Aboriginals land rights in favour of a mining corporation. The key concept that was used was the concept of terra nullius. Australia, the Aborigines were not deemed to hold the land because Australia, at the point of invasion, if we call it invasion, which we should, rather than discovery, was deemed to be terra nullius, unoccupied land. And it was deemed to be terra nullius because it was not being used in a manner deemed to be legitimately productive. I'm assuming that this sort of sounds bizarrely horrific, even for 1972, that there could be this concept of terra nullius, but it lasted up until then and up until the 1980s. So by assembling as an embassy and occupying land in front of the Australian Houses of Parliament, House of Parliament, the Aboriginal people were forced to seek refuge. Having been deprived of their homeland, they declared themselves to be aliens in their own land, yet they had nowhere other to flee, unlike other... They established an embassy, but they didn't have a homeland outside of Australia of which that embassy was representative. Now, rather than look back on this moment in Australian history as a point at which the Australian government should have granted Australian Aboriginal sovereignty and recognition of title, I want to argue that even had that happened, there was already something that was profoundly lost. It was the conceptual conditions of the entire discourse of embassies, sovereignty, seeking refuge, of nations, homeland, rightful existence, the very concept of native title, that was seen to be the remedy. That entire discourse, which is what had precipitated, enabled and sustained displacement. So one might say, and in fact that's what I'm going to say, is that in order to be a refugee or in order to seek the protections and representations that an embassy might afford, certain theoretical assumptions must be in play. Most notably those of personhood, sovereignty, nation, natality, or a notion of native title. Not only was the adoption of that discourse at that time in 1972 a complete loss of another way of thinking about land, humanity and relationships to the earth, all those notions, I argue, are today reaching their limit. I think they're unsustainable. Concepts of nation, sovereignty, refuge, citizenship. It's precisely those concepts that will have, are leading to the condition of refugee status for the entire human species. I hope that's going to be clear as I go on. That is to say, when Indigenous, Australian Indigenous people became refugees in their own land and had to seek nationhood by setting up as an external sovereign people, they had to make claims to sovereignty, as they did in the 1972 Tent Embassy, they had already bought into discourses of sovereignty that became compulsory precisely at the moment that they also became impossible. What I mean by that is, by the time the Aboriginal people were seeking sovereignty in 1972, the whole discourse of sovereignty was, in Australia and elsewhere, bound up with geopolitics and capitalism, such that even if, in some ideal counter-universe, the Australian federal government had said, OK, you can have native title, you can live your own way of life, that way of life, that Indigenous, non-sovereign way of life, was already impossible, already ruled out by a whole geopolitical arena of colonisation and capitalism. So what I want to do in what follows is tie that event of 1972 in Australian history of being rendered an alien in one's own land, not an exceptional condition that occurs at the end of the human species existence, but the condition for the possibility of what came to be the history of humanity. That is, I see the condition of being displaced within one's own land as the transcendental condition of life and humanity from which, for a very limited period, for a very limited number of humans, some form of national stability and sovereignty was extracted, but is now becoming impossible. Keep going. So, it's possible to say, distorting the work of Giorgio Agamben, that all humans are now becoming homo sacer. We're no longer protected by the rights and justices of personhood, but are becoming, increasingly, mere life to be exposed to the sheer difficulty of living on. But rather than consider this human exposure to fragility and mere life as a human-on-human condition within biopolitics, I'd like to consider what has seemed to be an exceptional and contentious category, that of the climate refugee, as an appropriate way of beginning to think humans in general. Humans as they are today, we are all climate refugees, will be climate refugees, and we always were. One might say that there's no refuge today. There is no refuge today from what has become the scale of the Anthropocene. That is, even if one never benefited from the hyper-consumptive, hyper-productive, hyper-destructive mode of capitalist colonization, even if you're living in a sinking island in the South Pacific, you can't say, well, it wasn't my fault, I'm buying out of this whole enterprise. In fact, you're precisely the one that is most subject to the effects of hyperproduction and the benefits that the rest of the world of nationhood and sovereignty accrue. So there's no refuge, increasingly, from what has become the scale of the Anthropocene. And this is increasingly so, even as that scale, the scale of the Anthropocene, casts every other potential humanity into the shadows. That is, it might have been possible once. Let's say, just pick a moment, 200 years ago, it might have been possible for the Indigenous Australian people to offer a different way of being human that would not have been destructive at a geological level. That's a good thought experiment. There would have been, let's say, when the British arrived in Australia, they had taken on, which was a possibility, taken on a different form of agriculture, of living on the earth that was not hyper-industrial. Had that happened, we might not be in the geological age of the Anthropocene. Of course, that didn't happen. So all those potential humanities not only did not occur, but are now no longer possible. So one might say that there's no refuge from what has become the scale of the Anthropocene, and this is increasingly so, even as now, even if you're a nation, to use that word broadly, that didn't take part in the spoils of humanity, you are most likely to be paying the price of a hyper-consumption you never enjoyed. The mode of hyper-consumption and hyper-production that generated a species capable of altering the dynamic of the earth as a living system. So the Anthropocene is not just climate change, it's not just wrecking an ecosystem, it's changing the planet at a geological level. That scale, that global geological scale, is merely an extension of the same global scale that generated colonisation, a supposedly universal humanity that just consumed other humans and other human energy for the sake of its own development. Today, in the light of the Anthropocene, we are increasingly told by geoengineers. So we're increasingly told that paths of ecological justice are no longer viable. So it might have once been the case that, let's say, Indigenous Australians could make a claim for living differently, that we could grant certain Indigenous peoples a different way of life. But we are now told, in a sort of too-big-to-fail moment, that the ecological crisis is now so great that we can't allow local autonomy and that the level of action now has to be shifted to the scale of the Anthropocene, which is the scale of geoengineering. So the possible of other modes of humanity, which we can now look back upon, that are discernible in the light of the failure of Western hyper-consumption, hyper-production, hyper-destruction, can now only appear as impossible paths not travelled. They're now closed off forever. So to take another example, there has been for decades a discourse of ecofeminism, that one might live with a different relation to the earth that was not global, systemic, single-scale and hyper-productive. That might have been a possibility once, but the scale of ecological destruction has now reached such a global level that no one can live that way. Putting it this way, living as a hippie is no longer possible. You can't buy out of the system. Right? I'm assuming that that's obvious, that if we all went and lived in... The Australian version would be Nimbin. You know, we all lived in an ecologically sustainable... It doesn't matter how good we are. It's game over. I mean, that's what I'm assuming. So that can be argued. But that there's no longer the possibility of a local community. The scale of ecological destruction is planetary, not at the level of ecosystems. This means that events of Indigenous claims that once represented possibilities now just represent impossibilities. So returning to that moment in 1972, I want to ask why the Aboriginal people of 1972 felt compelled to occupy a space and claim a certain type of sovereignty, and what was sacrificed in so doing. So one might make three observations regarding that the refuge taken within the Australian legal political system when the Australian Aboriginal people built that tent embassy in front of the houses in House of Parliament. In terms of geopolitics, to the Aboriginal people, and because of colonisation and its long reach, there was nowhere else to go. A land that had been lived multiply by different Aboriginal peoples was now a single nation under a single system of law, and there was therefore nowhere else to go. Once the Northern Territory had refused them land rights, there was nowhere else to go. They couldn't find another space. They were now aliens in their own land. This was so not only literally, spatially, but also discursively, where the opportunity to occupy a space required submitting to discourses of sovereignty, nationhood, title, and ownership. And where the colonisation of Australia as a single landmass precluded any possibility of dispersed, nomadic, and differing peoples. But beyond global colonisation and global legal discourse, I would argue that this event of scale and refuge takes us forward to questions of climate. Let us imagine that there was a possibility, perhaps in 1972, that the Australian government or the Northern Territory government, the state-ish government that had made the ruling, had, even within the discourse of sovereignty, granted Aboriginal people something like native title, or had weakened the extensiveness and intensity of colonial globalism in the manner of the later 1982 High Court decision of Mabo versus Queensland. Background, the 1972 decision was possible because of the concept of terra nullius, that Australia was unoccupied and therefore Crown land was Crown land, it was up for grabs. So the concept of Crown land. In 1982, in a landmark High Court judgment, that concept of terra nullius was overturned, and native type. It was a revolutionary decision, and yet, when you look at it from the position of today, incredibly miserable, because it didn't mean that everyone that was occupying owned land in Australia didn't own it anymore. Everyone who owned land. It just meant that the concept of terra nullius didn't apply, and that there could be claims for native title against, let's say, mining interests. So the later High Court decision of Mabo versus Queensland overruled the 1971 decision. But I would argue, even in that, both of those moments, the decision to grant native title and exclude the concept of terra nullius, that the land was previously occupied, needs to be understood within a concept of climate change, both in its narrow and broader sense. Climate change in its narrow sense was already in play by the time of 1982, when certain forms of dwelling that the Aboriginal peoples wanted to claim were no longer possible. The climate had been changed. Living as an Indigenous population was no longer possible. Yes, sovereignty was recognised, but the granting of native title took place within a geopolitical order of intensive industry that already generated a single scale of human capture. There was already no way in 1972 that Aboriginal peoples might have existed with their own temporality and their own geotemporality. Existing alongside late 20th century industrialism, there was not only encroaching economic and cultural imperatives that swept everything into the same scale, not only were other modes of existing with the earth being displaced by mining and industrialised agriculture, the colonising reach of Western capitalism and the intensive hyperconsumption that had led to deforestation, ocean acidification and global warming, while only reaching a recognisable pitch, let's say today in the 21st century, they were already underway as processes in 1972, 1970 and 1982. They had already generated the single ecological, catastrophic, economic and conceptual scale that we can now recognise only after the event of destruction. So Australian Aborigines, like all refugees, and I'm considering them refugees displaced from their own land, having to form an embassy within the Australian continent, they were already climate refugees. Indigenous peoples were displaced as a consequence of global capitalism's continued need for further space and resources. When, in 1972 and into the 21st century, mining interests supplanted all other ways of thinking about the earth, the relationship between Indigenous Australia and Eurasia and climate change simply became more explicit and more intensive. It was not something new. Again, I don't know how many of you are aware that Australia is possibly one of the most regressive nations when it comes to taxing carbon emissions and so forth, and so much so that Bruno Latour has said they're the only rational government, because every other government acknowledges that climate change exists and does nothing, whereas the Australian government really says, we're doing nothing because it doesn't exist. So that's actually rational to say, I don't believe in climate change, and let's just keep going. And Australia is currently going through an economic mining boom, which simply intensifies decisions about the earth and hyper-industry that I'm arguing were already in play. So forms of life that might not have generated geological impact, even though no one knew about or no one thought about geological impact in the early 1970s, forms of life that might not have generated geological impact, at least if we're thinking about the scale of geological stratigraphy, were always the victims of a mode of humanity that can now, in the waning light of hyperindustrialism, be referred to as Anthropocene man. So what I'm suggesting is that now that we can see the geological impact of humans on the planet, we can recognise that it was a specific type of humanity that was on a trajectory towards human extinction and destruction, and that other forms of humanity would have been better paths taken, but it's only now at the point of destruction and the point at which those paths are no longer possible that we can recognise these other modes of humanity. So that I want to suggest that we accept one of the main critics of certain forms of ecological politics. In fact, on his blog site, Clive Hamilton has written, "Ecologists just shut up," because he says, you think you can change the world with your ecological practices. You don't realise, you haven't read the literature. The Anthropocene is not about ecosystems, it's about the planet. And thinking that you can do things like recycle or do anything at a political level is just, you're just not reading the science properly. He's like a grumpy, like keeps complaining, ecologist, just shut up. Instead, we have to think of the scale of the Earth, and that requires geoengineering. We have to think of the Earth as a whole and its shift into a post-Holocene volatility. Now, what I want to do is say that that might be true. Here's, I guess, the argument part of my paper. That might be true at the level of actuality. It may be true that if humans want to survive in their current form, thinking about other forms of humanity is no longer possible. It's game over. We have to shift to geoengineering. So if we accept that humans need to survive in their current form, then other ecological political modes are not viable, and we have to shift to the scale of the Anthropocene. That's the condition at the level of actual brute fact. But what I'm trying to argue is that we don't accept that conditional, that we don't accept if humans want to survive as they are, then the only legitimate scale is the scale of the Anthropocene, and we should forget other possible forms of humanity. What I want to suggest that, and here's my sort of counter-conditional, even if it is game over, even if we are now on a path to destruction unless we take part in geoengineering, I'm suggesting that doesn't close off the possibility that we don't take the path of geoengineering. And even if, let's take this as a possibility, even if we explored other forms of humanity, such as those closer to Indigenous Australian forms of life, it might not enable the human species to survive in its current form, but maybe survival in its current form isn't the prima facie value. So, what I want to question first is the non-negotiable scale of the Anthropocene. We may accept at the level of geological fact that we have shifted from a Holocene period of planetary stability to a post-Holocene period of planetary geological Earth system instability. We may accept that at the level of fact, but that doesn't mean the geological scale or the geoengineering scale is the only legitimate political scale. It may be the only scale that's legitimate if we are accepting that the one project is human survival. But what I want to question is whether human survival, particularly in terms of historically forward human survival, I mean, maybe there are forms of human survival that don't rely on humans staying alive. Maybe us just leaving stuff lying around is a form of human survival. Maybe just leaving an archive there for whatever's left. Too much Deleuze, I guess, once I start talking about human survival without humans. So what I wanted to argue for is that the non-negotiable scale of the Anthropocene is not non-negotiable, and that the shift in scale from the from political to the geological is one shift, but that there are also other shifts in political scale that might allow us to think about different conceptions of living on this earth. So returning to the Aboriginal tent embassy, where Indigenous Australians had already lost the battle to fight at a political, historical scale broader than that of Western colonising history. So when the tent embassy formed, there was one scale, the scale of Western colonising history, of sovereignty and nation, where the only mode of occupying a space was to use the discourse of sovereignty and nationhood. We can say today, now that we know what the Anthropocene will have been, that Aboriginal claims for land were already caught up in the single scale of global territorialisation. So here, and it's in conclusion, I'm going to like two more pages. I want to draw upon Deleuze and Guattari's theorisation of the genesis of man, and by man I don't mean humans. There's humans and then there's man. The genesis of man by way of a theory of stratification. If territorialisation produces a relatively stable identity by way of an occupation of space, so we live in so far as we migrate and occupy, and in which tendencies enter into relation to become quantities, deterritorialisation establishes another strata, another layer that allows those various stratifications to be seen as emerging from some governing ground. So we could see the global system of sovereignty as a strata that overrides various territories. Prior to relations and organisation, there is deemed to be some condition for relations. That's deterritorialisation. It follows that higher deterritorialisation would involve destroying that stratification and seeing various systems of relation and interaction as existing without foundation or without ground. In this respect, we might imagine from the closure of the Anthropocene, once everything has been scaled up, that there are other human histories that were not actualised but that haunt the present. In this respect, one could see various mythic systems that were outside Western globalism and Western industrialisation as different ways of ordering relations, of different ways of thinking about the earth. Following Eduardo Viveros de Castro, one could think of the way in which each aspect of the world unfolds a different way of making sense of the world, generating multiple and divergent scales. Humans identify and differentiate themselves through other forces in the world. Western humans have done it one way, but there are other ways of thinking the time and space of the world. Even if at the level of brute fact and actuality, there can be no retrieval of a pre-Anthropocene world where one might have lived without reaching the intensity of planetary destruction, one might think in these closing days, in the light of what we know, of living as if other temporalities and planes were possible. Rather than say that the 21st century is marked by knowing what we need to do in order to survive and yet we continue to act otherwise, we might think of knowing full well that the game of survival and extension is no longer possible. So, and that this thought generates a virtual counter-history. So in concrete terms, what I'm trying to do is say, acting ecologically, I'm sort of crossing out the Naomi Klein thesis, where Naomi Klein argues acting ecologically will give us this world but better. Right? Acting ecologically will give us this world but better. I'm arguing acting ecologically won't give us this world. The only thing it might do is give us another world. It might help us to survive, but maybe survival is not the only value. There's no other planet. There's no other history. There is now no other possible humanity. And yet, the potentiality of the history that is not actualised might open another world in the present. So I'm not arguing that there will be some golden future if we behave differently. I'm just arguing that there might be a different present or a different end. a potentiality or virtual humanity that might have been other than the hyper-consuming industrialized humanity that generated the Anthropocene was once still imaginable, if not possible, at the time of the formation of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy and possible maybe at the later time of the Mabo decision. But even at that point, which was also the beginning of a sense of the destructiveness of global technoscience, those displaced by colonisation and its ravages could only seek refuge within and thereby confirm the same system of nationhood, sovereignty and land ownership that led to the hyper-destruction we're experiencing in the present. The humanity of high industrialism is today recognising that its global reach and inescapability is precisely that which will make any sort of actual refuge impossible. So the lifestyle that we are mourning and yet want to sustain is not only the lifestyle that got us to this mess in the first place, it's also one that's erasing any other possible future. It's possible to recognise today, by way of the all-encompassing and non-negotiable scale of the Anthropocene, where all parts of the Earth are now caught up in the predicament generated by one mode of colonising humanity, that the single scale or single system thinking that allowed for the historical success of one portion of humanity at the expense of others, and that enables all the technological expertise capable of theorising the Anthropocene, is also one from which we now have no refuge. So here I do not want to confuse the geological conception of scale that marks the Anthropocene with the global human scale that marks the history of colonisation. But what I do want to do is question the notion of single scale or proper scale, or the idea that even if actuality and survival are tied to a single scale, that thought should follow in allowing one register or strata to subsume all others. Whatever the past injustice and potentiality of other modes of humanity might have been, the trajectory of Western hyperconsumption and colonisation has led to an inescapable interconnectedness that at once erases and consumes those modes of being not aligned with the trajectory of the Anthropocene. In this respect, one might say, and this is my conclusion, I was going to conclude with a reading of Chris Nolan's film Interstellar, because it's precisely about the entire species of humanity being a climate refugee. And that can only be imagined by travelling in time to another planet. But that just shows that there is no refuge. The dream of refuge elsewhere shows that there is no refuge. In this respect, and this is my conclusion, I would argue that all refugees are climate refugees, that the history of human migration and human stability, which is really a history that just refuses migration to some, is that all refugees are climate refugees, displaced by forms of war and colonisation that are tied to overconsumption and overproduction. So that not only are all refugees climate refugees, humanity in general is now approaching the condition of being a climate refugee. We have nowhere else to go. Our home is increasingly inhospitable. And yet there is no one to whom we can seek hospitality. All humans, even and especially those who have suffered from Western colonising globalism, are now finding the space of the Earth to be inhospitable, and yet also finding that the seeking of refuge keeps them within the very system that caused displacement. Skipping over. The section on Interstellar. As long as we remain focused on survival and actuality, then it may be true to say that it is now impossible to think of all alternate human temporalities and scales, and that claims for localism, nomadism, non-sovereign forms of assembling, and non-anthropocentric forms of relating to the planet are no longer viable. So if we remain geared towards survival, then thinking of other modes of humanity is no longer viable. We have to go towards geoengineering. If humans really are climate refugees, then we need to think about how we might refind what counts as human or what we have a right to respect on other terms. What if we were to think of the humanity that we are now trying to sustain as a mode of hyperproduction and hyperconsumption that eliminates all other scales, histories, and all possibility of refuge? If this were so, then rather than include climate refugees within privileged conditions of global humanity, yes, climate refugees really are refugees, they're not economic migrants, which precludes the fact that every human is an economic migrant. We're all seeking opportunism where someone else doesn't have it. And rather than think of humanity as now having to seek its conditions elsewhere or by other means, we might think of the virtual, erased, lost and impossible modes of human existence, not because they offer survival, that's my claim, but because they are not tied to the temporality of survival. So I'm rejecting the condition if we are to survive. I'm rejecting that as a conditional. I don't think that that's an assumption that we can or should make. The wars of empire and nation that had created the possibility of closed borders, sovereign protection, and sovereign refuge were already, as we can see now, part of a history of climate change in which the plenty of liberal humanity was bought at the cost of destabilizing other ecosystems. So rather than see climate refugees as persons who should and could legitimately be included within a privileged domain of liberal humanity, I see the history of liberal humanity as achieved only by displacing other people into an inhospitable climate. And finally, an inhospitable Earth system. Last 10 lines. What we know as timeless climate stability or nature is the effect of an ongoing history of anthropogenic climate change that has proceeded by expropriating energy from parts of the Earth, including humans and other animals. What we know as climate stability, the nature of Western poetry, philosophy, timeless nature, what we know as nature and climate stability has been achieved by a long history of disturbance and appropriation of other forms of human life that had always lived with climate volatility. So climate stability was achieved at the expense of intensifying the climate volatility for others. The more climate stability in the motif of the universal liberal person became global, the higher the price paid for some humans and the greater the burden on those who appeared always as climate refugees. So I would like to see what happened to the Australian Indigenous people, that their way of life was erased, that their climate was no longer rendered hospitable to their own way of living with the earth. That is not an exceptional condition. That's the history of humanity. So to conclude, the narrative needs to be reversed. What we think of as humanity, and especially certain forms of post-humanity, was achieved by taking refuge in a certain part of the globe, Europe, allowing the rest of the planet to deal with the volatility and precariousness that have only now, in the twilight of the Anthropocene, come to light. Thank you.
All right, we have about we have about 10 minutes. If anyone has any questions for Professor Colbert.
I'll start with a question.
Thanks.
I'm just thinking of the work of somebody like Boaventura de Sousa Santos and the way he's, you know, that huge project that he did across Latin America, Africa, and Asia, where, you know, he posits this new epistemology of the indigenous epistemologies of the ethic in South Africa, called Ubuntu, for instance. Or, you know, he lists the different kind of ethics. So this is very much what you were dealing with. And he sees that as very much the way forward. but tries to think it so it's not a new form of Orientalism, which is a critique that Etienne Balibar has made of his project. So I just, is that what you're actually taking a stand against that work?
Here's the problem of actual temporality, or the actual history of knowledge, is that, and which is why I use the notion of twilight. The very condition for us, let's just say we're, because I am, you know, I've read Deleuze, right, who has this, on the one hand, incredibly Eurocentric, ethnocentric notion of the emergence of a global way of thinking. One can see the destructiveness of that trajectory only after it's already incurred its destruction. And one can see the value of non-universalizing modes of reference and relating to the earth only after they've been erased.
And the forms of being and knowledge.
Yeah, so one could... So then you're left in this awful... position where you use Deleuze to read the history of Western thought, that then leads you to other modes of thought and you see their value, but you can't then bring out the eraser, and you know, like one can't go back. So one only acknowledges multiple perspectives from a position that can see multiple perspectives. And I guess there's what I'm trying to do is there's an epistemological problem there, that, and this is what I like, the brutality of fact is there was this globalizing trajectory, epistemologically, ecologically, politically, economically, that one can see the path not taken only after its erasure. Now one could just say game over, okay, we're stuck with it. But that's not what I want to do. So that's the first thing, is to say, what would those other forms of virtual humanity offer, even if now there's no point of innocence. It's a non-linear temporality. You can't go back. But that doesn't make it valueless, because one, you know, contamination is fine. The other thing I have, though, the problem is with when I'm looking at is the exceptional nature of a certain mode of non-perspectival universalism. Because you don't want to say too easily, well, there's people doing work on African thought and Amerindian thought and Indigenous Australian thought, and they're all like this, which is what you're saying, like a new mode of Orientalism, as opposed to the West, right? But one does want to say that there is perhaps something singular about a Western globalism, precisely because it achieved a form of economic and colonising reach that then enabled a certain form and was coupled with a certain form.
If one gets rid of... can I just respond
to
this? If one gets rid of the idea that we have to survive...
Yeah, that's what
in the twilight, as we... go to this deep space that someone Millis like Mayesu,
yeah,
you know, sort of described, has found a way to kind of posit. If one thinks about that ahead in the future, a deep space without the human as we know it, while we're approaching this kind of twilight, to be contaminated by the indigenous forms, that's not quite the right way, but to learn other ways of being and other ways of knowing.
I mean, I think the Mayesu is the opposite, okay, because you've got this notion of, well, one could think in the absence of any,
yeah,
you know, there's a notion, yeah, of thinking as such.
But it's just the idea that to posit a deep space. He posits one that precedes...
I was actually going in the other direction, yeah, that there's a notion that if you die and you leave your bones in the earth, that's a form of survival.
Yeah.
And if you leave an inscription and it's going to decay over,
yeah,
hundreds of years, that's a form of life, right? And that If you take, I mean, I'm not familiar with Amerindian or African modes of thought, but it does, why the notion of life and one's own life has to be one's physical bounded person, right? Why it has to be thinking, you know, in Mayus's sense, you know, thinking in the absence of, you know, of specific human bodies, and that there's forms of, like, would it be the worst thing in the world if humans didn't, you know, it's like, why do we think it's the ultimate tragedy? We came, we lived, and that the survival at all costs has a big cost, right? And it's usually not us, right? And where one is, so that's where I'm going with, like, survival without humans is not deep space. I'm talking about, you know, rotting in the earth.
Yes?
If I understood correctly, is the question perhaps not can Toulouse believe in the planet, but can the earth still believe in man? If I've understood what you're saying, that's what I'm hearing you say. Can the earth actually believe in man? And the other thought was that, in terms of your tent that's erected outside the embassy, perhaps today's equivalent is the Australian refusing to allow anybody from an Ebola country to go to Australia.
I mean, so the this notion of the earth, you know, when I hear Deleuze back at me, I'm like, why did I? I realise how crazy I must have sound then, you know, like, and I want to go, so I want to go, like, into quite concrete, literal, when you say, like, the earth, does the earth believe, I think there are forms of human dwelling that don't think, well, here's the survival of humans as a whole, right, and what would it take, you know, how much do we have to, how much fishing or farming do we have to give up in order for us to survive? So here's humans, and if we're nice to non-humans, it's in a condition of us negotiating our relationship to a planet that's our climate or our milieu. When you say things like, does the Earth believe in humans, it might be, well, this is the perspectivalism. You know, if one were a non-human, why would one grant us any privileged right to existence? And of course, we are humans, and we do have a parochial interest in our own survival that we can't erase. But what I'm questioning is not the Earth's belief in us, because I'm sure if the Earth, I mean, Isabel Stenger says, there's, you know, like, the Earth had we could come and go, the Earth doesn't care about us, right? Other animals, I mean, might care about us only if we went away, they might have more of a chance. What I'm arguing is, I guess, is that a certain portion of humans should stop believing in humans. And this is where I went, like, if you go to any of these terrible films that I have to go and see because of their research, like Interstellar or Elysium or Oblivion, or it's blimey, we're gonna what do we have to do to survive, right? And that's taken as an prima facie assumption. We might die, therefore, right? We might cease to exist, therefore. And I would say there are forms of humanity, Indigenous Australia, that are like, you know, the existence of some humans is not necessarily something that overrides all other considerations. So I'd rephrase your question, not does the Earth believe in humans, but certain humans don't believe in humans. There are certain forms of human culture that don't think that human survival is the prima facie ultimate value that overrides all else. And that's why I'm questioning Anthropocene and geoengineering, because geoengineering is like, if humans are going to survive, this is the only way we're going to go. Just as in the economic bailout, if capitalism's, you know, like, if we're going to survive, this is the only way we're going to go. And it's like, I think we should question those conditionals about survival and what's worth keeping.
All right. We have just a couple quick minutes if anyone wants to grab